is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Joseph Ellis. His new book is The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontents, critical, 1773 to 1783. Professor, congratulations and good evening. I go immediately to your title because it requires much explanation. Who called what we now see the revolution the cause, and why did they call it the cause? Good evening to you.
Good evening, team. The cause is what the American colonists began to use as a term to describe their opposition to British policy in the mid-1770s. And nobody called it the American Revolution at that time, or even until at the end of the war. The British called it the American Rebellion. And originally, the phrase was the common cause. It was a term that the 12 other colonies used to describe their willingness to support Massachusetts when Massachusetts was occupied by the British Army in the wake of the Tea Party and what's called the Coercive Acts as a way of punishing that particular colony. Once you get to the summer of 76, the common cause becomes simply the cause. And I see it as a kind of verbal canopy over a variety of interest groups. New England doesn't think the same way as Virginia. There are different religious groups, and there's a fundamental difference on the issue of slavery. And so it's a way of gathering people into the same tent. And what they have in common, the cause in its simplest form, is hostility to British policy and then a desire to secede from the British Empire and claim its own independence. It comes to mean more things, as I think you're going to ask me about, early on in the game. It begins to have radical meaning. So what we have here is a war for a colonial independence that has and begins to have a revolutionary agenda attached to it.
There are fresh faces in your telling, people who have been at the margins of my understanding of the war until now. John Dickinson, Nathaniel Green, John Jay, and Robert Morris. I celebrate John Jay, but we must go immediately to someone who's extremely famous and a major player in the cause. That would be George III. George III assumes his office, his throne, in 1763. However, by 1773, he has a very strong opinion of his empire and how he wants it to be regarded by rival empires like France and Spain. George III is a Hanoverian. He is the first, as you say, of the German princes who was raised in Britain and spoke English easily. However, he has a vision of himself as a very powerful man built on something that is revelatory to me. He had money to buy Parliament. What did that give him in power over the American cause?
It meant that he had £800,000, I believe it is, to spend based on the Royal Treasury to essentially purchase the interest of about 30% of the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And so while George III, in moving towards a policy of war with America, claimed that he was doing it to defend Parliament's authority, in fact, Parliament was under his control. And so it was really a monarchical act. In the Glorious Revolution, the English government became what they said, king in Parliament. Parliament was the most powerful, and the king was symbolic. Here, George III is making the king himself much more powerful. And if you look at the end of the story, when they lose the war, the British revoke the ability of the monarch to use their money to own the Parliament. And no British monarch after George III ever exercises the same degree of power that he does. But in his vision of the British Empire, which becomes his vision of himself, if we allow these American bumpkins to leave, what will happen to Canada? What will happen to Jamaica? What will happen to Malta? What will happen to India? And so it's something that a lot of Americans can recognize as an early version of what I believe Eisenhower first called the domino theory. And so everything was at stake. If we concede anything to the Americans at this moment in time, the entire British Empire could fall apart.
A series of parliamentary actions that offended the colonies. What's critical here is that the way the colonies thought about this, it wasn't their regent punishing them. They called it parliamentary dictatorship or a monarchical parliamentary dictatorship. Where did that derive from? What understanding did they have of the power of parliament?
The Americans claimed, with a great deal of evidence at their support, that the British Constitution, after the Glorious Revolution, made parliament primary sovereign, but that no British citizen could be taxed without his or her consent, and that they were themselves the conservatives in this argument. They were insisting upon their rights as British citizens, and it was Great Britain that was changing the rules of the game and saying that colonists are not really full-blooded British citizens. So in this argument over the Sugar Act, the Stamp Act, the Townsend Act, that's the underlying issue that's occurring. And the cause is a phrase to describe a view that government cannot take your rights from you without your consent. That a government that is coercive is tyrannical. And what the colonists end up saying, and it's hard for people to believe this, is there is a plot afoot to enslave us. There wasn't a plot to enslave. There was a plan afoot to impose a greater degree of control over the colonies than had existed before. Burke said that the years before were the period of benign neglect. Well, benign neglect is over, and now we're going to actually govern you. And that kind of government was being characterized by the colonists as a form of tyranny and a form of slavery.
Well, it's a joy to discover that Benjamin Franklin understood all this in a fashion that suggests he had a modern sense of humor. In 1773, he published a book, Rules by Which a Great Empire May Be Reduced to a Small One, pointing to Parliament's abuse of his native land, America. Did that wit penetrate Parliament? Did they listen to Franklin, or did they mock him?
They mocked him, as you know. They brought him before a trial of it's a version of the Privy Council, and essentially humiliated him in public. And they didn't know it, but they had just alienated what they eventually come to call the American Prometheus. Franklin didn't want to break with the British Empire. Franklin had a vision of the future that the Brits could have embraced. And he was trying to tell them this, that if you can meet us halfway in our desire to be able to have sovereign control of our own legislatures, we'll tax ourselves and we'll still go along on the Navigation Act as part of the British Empire. It would have meant the creation 100 years earlier of the British Commonwealth. Later in the war, once things aren't going very well, they say, oh, okay, we'll go do what you want to, but it's too late by then. And Franklin is among the founders, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about him. Franklin is the wisest, and he becomes an asset for the American cause that is incalculable as a diplomatic negotiator. And he's late to the cause because he really wants to avoid this at all costs. And when it's impossible, when the British are intransigent, when the British humiliate him, that's when he writes Rules by Which a Great Empire May Be Reduced to a Small One.
Very quickly now, the Tea Party in December of 73, the coercive acts directed against New England to punish New England for its dissent in 1774. George III speaks and writes aloud, "The die is now cast, submit or triumph," March 7th, 1774. When we come back, Continental Congress in action. The book is The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontents. Joseph Ellis is the author. I'm John Batchelor.